Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is John Pfeffer, who's the co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. Previously worked as an associate editor of World Policy Journal and has been an international affairs representative in Eastern Europe and East Asia for the American Friends Service Committee. His books include Beyond Détente, Soviet Foreign Policy and U.S. Options, Shockwaves, Eastern Europe After the Revolutions, and his latest, Crusade 2.0, The West's Resurgent War on Islam. He has an article at Foreign Policy in Focus, Brown is the New Black in Russia. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Pfeffer.
Thanks for having me on the show, Ian.
And John, I was just speaking then with Strobe Talbot, and I must say it was a bit of a surprise to hear him say, since he's served under Bill Clinton and is a Democrat, he was critical of Henry Kissinger's advice, which is not to even to take off the table permanently any talk of Ukraine joining NATO. He felt that that was a mistake, that at some point in the future that option should be kept on the table.
Yes, I wasn't surprised. I mean, under Clinton, NATO expansion pursued very vigorously, and the Democrats were very much committed to pushing NATO as far east as possible. And although Strobe Talbot, of course, is very sensitive to, you know, the feelings and the perceptions of Russia, I think he also is very much committed to NATO as an institution that is as strong and as broadly pushed as possible. So Henry Kissinger, on the other hand, is simply looking at the geopolitics of the situation. He doesn't care so much whether NATO as an institution lives or dies in Ukraine. He's most interested in seeking some kind of amity between Washington and Moscow. So it's really a question of emphasis, I think.
So let's turn to your article, John Pfeffer, at Foreign Policy in Focus, Brown is the New Black in Russia. And I guess the first context is to point out that throughout the West in Europe, you've seen the resurgence of the new right now happening in France. You've got Jobbik in Hungary. In fact, the Hungarian government is dangerously moving in a very, very nasty right-wing direction. You've got Ataka in Bulgaria, Golden Dawn in Greece, and of course in Ukraine you've got Svoboda and the right sector. But you've also got bubbling beneath the surface some extremely ugly right-wing nationalism in Russia itself. So give us a comparison if you can.
Sure. Well, I think first it's important to point out that the right has surged throughout Europe and in the former Soviet Union, in part because of the discrediting of the left. And in the eastern part, of course, in Eastern Europe and in the former Soviet Union, left is often associated with communism and the failures of communism. And that created clearly a vacuum on the left side of the political spectrum, even when the communist parties renamed themselves social democratic parties and attempted to distance themselves from their communist past. In Western Europe, there was a push toward neoliberalism in the economic sphere, a push that even the left, even social democratic parties, embraced when they came to power, whether it was in France or the Third Way in England. And that, to a certain extent, discredited the left. So in this vacuum, in which no party was really reaching out to the people who were most adversely affected by the economic transformations of the last 20 years, the right wing has moved right in there. You can kind of say it's similar to the Tea Party here in the United States, but in a much more aggressive and much more, frankly, racist way. These groups have identified minorities such as Roma or Jews as being the culprits behind the economic dislocation, and they have mobilized all of the people that have been left behind by political and economic transition over the last 20 years, and they have not been challenged by any major, credible, authentic, independent left, and so they have prospered. So I think that's what all of these right-wing groups that you mentioned, from Greece to France to Russia, that's the background that links them all together.
So, in terms of the idea, as some who I've interviewed ever since this situation between Russia and Ukraine developed, a couple of people have said, you know, beware that what you wish for. As much as one can easily criticize Putin for being an authoritarian, having total power, being the new czar, being the capo di capo, the head of a mafia state, regulating the oligarchs and perhaps shaking them down to the point where he may be one of the richest men in the world. And that Yanukovych, the guy that just got deposed in Ukraine, is a small fry compared to Putin. All of that notwithstanding, there is this cautionary note, which is that you could get worse than Putin if, for example, he were to invade Ukraine and turn bloody, and there was a backlash. What kind of government would likely to come to the fore? I'm told that it would be an ugly right-wing nationalist government. So what do you think?
Yes, well, I think that Putin in many ways has positioned himself to steal both the ideas and the thunder from the right, from the far right in Russia. And I'm be happy to talk a little bit more about that. But first, I wanted to distinguish what's taking place in Russia from what's taking place in Ukraine. Because there's been a lot of press about the rise of fascism in Ukraine, the incorporation of especially Svoboda into the government, the transitional government in Kiev, the threat that fascism will take over, really, in Ukraine. I think that, yes, right sector and Svoboda are very troubling phenomena. They're clearly far-right-wing, neo-fascist organizations. But they have, at the moment, limited appeal. They were able to gain their position in part because of the upheaval of the revolutionary or quasi-revolutionary situation in Ukraine, where they were willing to take risks that others weren't. They were willing to take a hard line where others were a little bit more diffident. And in that kind of a situation, they were able to propel themselves forward. Now, as we've seen with the Ukrainian government's killing of one of the leaders of right sector, that can be perceived as a threat, obviously, by the current government in Kiev, that this right sector is, in fact, a rogue element. But in any case, they have relatively little base in Ukraine. In the upcoming presidential election, it's estimated that the far right will get very few votes. And if there were a parliamentary election held, they too would get relatively little representation in parliament. In Russia, the situation is somewhat different. Of course, we're not in a revolutionary situation in Russia. We're not in a situation in which fringe elements can come forward and claim the political sphere, because essentially what we have is a far right that has grown in sophistication and in its kind of understanding of both global politics and Russian politics for the last 20 to 25 years. And instead of those figures taking over in Russia, they've in fact simply pulled Vladimir Putin to the right. They have influenced his politics in very important ways. For instance, one of the kind of key leaders in the neo-fascist movement in Russia today would be Vladimir Zhirinovsky. And Zhirinovsky is the head of a party he calls the Liberal Democratic Party. Of course, it's neither liberal nor democratic. He is often been considered the kind of clown prince of Russian politics because he makes such bold and, frankly, absurd proposals, such as retaking Alaska from the United States or surging south and retaking countries that were part of the Russian Empire in the 18th and 19th century or giving away free alcohol. And yet he has managed to hold on to his political position to, in fact, grow his political constituency in Russia. He is now a speaker of the Duma. He says things which continue to be radical, which continue to be perhaps the most kind of imperialist or expansionist in terms of Russian foreign policy. But whereas in the 1990s, his views were just outside the ballpark. Boris Yeltsin and the crowd around Boris Yeltsin certainly paid no attention to him whatsoever. But these days, his views begin to resonate at much higher levels of Russian governance, reaching even to Vladimir Putin himself.
Well, just in terms of the right sector and Svoboda in Ukraine, as you point out, that they have very little traction there and they won't do very well in the polls. They'll be in the low digits, certainly not in the double digits. But one of the problems that is with the current government is that there's a disproportionate number of them in the cabinet, which far outweighs their electoral appeal. So that's troubling. Now, maybe the fact that they shot one of the leaders, the government did, that might have sent them a message. But I don't understand why, given how much the Russians, Putin and Lavrov, are beating the drum on this idea that the Ukrainian government is all a bunch of neo-Nazis, fascists and anti-Semites, why the hell they don't purge these people?
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know if I'd say it's certainly disproportionate to their support in the population as a
right,
whole.
Right.
It's probably not disproportionate to their representation in the actual Maidan movement, unfortunately. I mean, the
right.
Maidan movement was, you know, a very diverse group. It had people on the left, people in the center, and, of course, people on the far right as well. But again, you know, these guys were the shock troops. These were the ones who...
They took the casualties, right?
Weapons.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I think that's, in some sense, why the government did this. They recognized that if they didn't do this, they would face opposition, not from a large number of people, but from a large militant number of people.
Right.
And this is a transition government. I think, you know, they gave them a couple of positions, frankly, which are not all that important. They have four, maybe five out of 19 or 20 positions in the government and the ministries. And with the resignation of the defense minister, that number drops. Another guy's like head of forestry or something. So it's not like they have an enormous amount of power. One fellow does, but since he's rather high up in the advisory council. But
on the National Security
Council,
right, yeah. The deputy head of the National Security Council.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But in general, I wouldn't say that they certainly are not pulling the strings. And I would also say that they don't have a great deal of support by the backers of Ukraine, either in EU or the United States. I mean, there have been all sorts of conspiracy theories put out there that somehow the United States government wants to see these right sector Svoboda people in charge of things in Ukraine today. And that's frankly absurd because these guys, like the right wing throughout Europe, throughout the former Soviet Union, they are against European Union, which they see as a kind of bureaucracy that threatens to take away the sovereignty of their country. And they tend to be anti-American as well for a variety of reasons. But even without those particular ideologies, they're very unpredictable. And if there's one thing that Washington wants, it's predictability. And that's why they always choose, you know, guys who've studied in London or Washington or are bankers or what have you. That's, to them, spells predictability, not these guys who, you know, carry guns and say all sorts of outlandish things about Ukrainian history and Jews and so forth.
Sure. Well, just in closing, though, John Pfeffer, in terms of the pot calling the kettle black and the extent to which there is a lot more anti-Semitism and neo-Nazi traction within Russia itself than there is in Ukraine, it's worth noting, when we're talking about the Ukrainian government makeup, that the deputy prime minister of Russia, Dmitry Rogozin, is way out there on the far right. So it's not like the Russian Duma doesn't have its right-wing representation.
That's correct. And, you know, it's important to look at policies because, you know, what Russia is concerned about, what Russian nationalists are concerned about, are the lives of ethnic Russians in the so-called near abroad, in the neighboring countries to Russia. And for a certain class of far right, they definitely want to resurrect not so much the Soviet Union, because they have problems with the Soviet Union as an institution. They'd rather go a little further back in time and resurrect the Russian Empire. They want to not only ensure that the livelihoods of Russians in the near abroad, whether we're talking about Latvia or Kazakhstan, are secure, but that those territories themselves are locked much closer to Russia. And this kind of form, what I call a kind of extreme version of Eurasianism, which dates back to the 1920s, is an extraordinarily troubling phenomenon. There are moderate versions of Eurasianism, and there are some parts of Putin's foreign policy which highlight a kind of moderate Eurasianism, such as, you know, a much more voluntary association of Eurasian countries. But the Rogozins of Russia, the Zhirinovskis, have a much more extreme Russia-only white Slavic view of kind of pure space, animated by Russian nationalism and set up very strongly as an anti-European and anti-American bloc.
Well, John Pfeffer, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Again, I've been speaking with John Pfeffer, who's the co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. Previously, he worked as an associate editor of World Policy Journal and has been an international affairs representative in Eastern Europe and East Asia for the American Friends Service Committee. His books include Beyond Détente, Soviet Foreign Policy and U.S. Options, Shockwaves, Eastern Europe After the Revolutions, and his latest, Crusade 2.0, The West's Resurgent War on Islam. He has an article at Foreign Policy and Focus, Brown is the New Black in Russia. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back and examining the emerging Republican strategy to limit Democratic votes in pivotal swing states in the upcoming midterm election.